All right, Alexander, we are drifting towards conflict. I really hope people watch this channel, share these videos, and understand where we're heading. And when I mean conflict, a great power conflict. We had this conversation the other day with Gonzalo Lira and at the CRP channel. And, you know, we talked about how we are walking towards a U.S., NATO, Russia, Ukraine conflict, or a U.S.-China-Taiwan conflict. And now we have embassy expulsions.
That's right.
The United States is 27 diplomats. I've heard 54. I've also heard 27.
Yeah. But it's in two cycles. What they're doing in order to try to avoid the appearance that they're actually expelling these diplomats is that they're revoking visas. So in effect, after the visas expire, they're saying they won't renew them. And of course, if these diplomats remain there, then they will cease to be diplomats. And well, we know that they then lose immunity, and then the United States does all that. So essentially, this is a disguised form of expulsion, and it's going to be in two cycles. One is now, the next one is going to be in June. So the United States is essentially throwing out, I think it's 54, whatever it was.
54 is whatever, yeah.
Exactly, 54 Russian diplomats. Russians have made it very clear that they will retaliate. The US embassy in Moscow has gone down from a staff of 1,200 diplomats and diplomatic personnel in 2017 to just 120 now. It's shrinking. And of course, if it now loses another 50, then I mean, it's going to become almost a skeleton force. I mean, there won't be enough people basically to run it. Now, given that this is so, all the bridges of contact are being cut away. The explanation for this from the United States is that they want the Russians to change their policy towards the US embassy in Moscow. They want, in effect, the Russians to cave. The Russians say they won't cave. The Russians say they will retaliate. They say that it's the US that needs to make moves on the embassy situation. The overall effect, the actual reality, is that diplomatic contacts between America and Russia, two of the world's most powerful countries, are rapidly heading towards total breakdown, to a situation where the embassies in Moscow and Washington become unviable and can't function anymore. And quite possibly, because, of course, the United Nations is based in New York, which is in the United States, we could start to see inroads into the Russian mission to the United Nations and to the Security Council too. Now, when there are no diplomatic contacts to speak of, then, of course, the prospects for miscalculation intensify to an unheard-of level. And then at that point, of course, conflict becomes much more likely. And that is happening. This new round of expulsions has happened just after the Biden administration opened up talks with the Russians for a new Biden-Putin summit. And it seems that the hardliners in Congress and in the State Department have responded to that by this new round of embassy expulsions. And there doesn't seem to be anything that the White House can do about it.
Right, the State Department being the neocon.
Absolutely, neocon central. Exactly.
So there's two ways to look at this, I guess. There's the really pessimistic way. Maybe you could look at it in an optimistic way. The pessimistic way is, are these two countries, the U.S. and Russia, are they moving their chess pieces in a way so that they are ready for the inevitable war that's coming, the inevitable conflict, which will most likely be in the theater of Ukraine? So are they getting rid of diplomats, reducing personnel in each other's embassies in order to prepare for this conflict because they know it's coming. So let's just start the preparation for it. That's the really pessimistic way, which is probably the more realistic way to look at this. Or could this be a sign that, you know, we're not going to head towards conflict, but we're going to try to avoid conflict, but you know what? This is a bipolar or a multipolar world, depending on how you look at it. We're breaking off from each other. Eventually, the UN is not going to deal with Russia, maybe even with China, with one pole of the world. It'll deal with a different pole of the world. Russia, China, these countries, Eurasia, will have their own gigs, their own things, their own IMFs, their own internets, their own SWIFTs. We're just, this is a decoupling, and we're getting the process going. But at least we won't step into, at least for the short term or medium term, step into some sort of great power conflict.
Well, I think there's a number of things to say. Let's start with one from a Russian point of view, positive thing. Apparently, the massive scaling down of the US embassy in Moscow has essentially led to a complete collapse of the CIA operation in Russia. So, I mean, they're not able to involve themselves in Russian domestic politics in the way that they did. And, I mean, it's often joked that, you know, the one way to secure yourself against regime change, if you're a country, is not to have a US embassy on your territory. So, I mean, from a Russian point of view, it does come with that particular advantage. And be very clear, that is a real advantage. I mean, there are people in Moscow who are making that point. So it's there is that side of it. Now, will we eventually get to that complete decoupling? I think yes. I think the directory of travel is exactly in that direction. Within days that we're speaking, the Russian and Chinese prime ministers are going to be meeting, and that they're increasingly talking about integration of their economies, working out all the things that you said, joint, you know, internet connections, all those things that you were talking about. They're absolutely on their agenda, and they're not just on their agenda. They are really happening. They are actually taking place. So this decoupling is indeed going to take place. Problem is, you have this period in between when there are all these unresolved issues, Taiwan being one, Ukraine being another. And of course, you have something else, which is that, of course, if you are somebody in Washington who's following a globalist agenda, then, of course, the very last thing you want is to see a decoupling like that and the creation of powerful blocs in that sort of way. Because, of course, that your globalist agenda at that point becomes impossible. So in that kind of situation, you can see that if you're a globalist diplomat, or neocon diplomat in Washington, your inclination is going to be to try and crank up the pressure on either the Chinese or the Russians. More practically, it has to be the Russians. And at the same time, with all these unresolved issues in the meantime, and with communications breaking down, the risk of a war becomes much more real. So you have a period of time between the setting up of these two blocs before all sorts of tensions exist and become extremely severe. If we go back to the first Cold War, people, I think, underestimate how dangerous the first 15 years of that first Cold War was. The first Cold War only really stabilized, and you only finally got a situation where the real danger of war began to subside after the crisis in Berlin in 1961, which led to the setting up of the Berlin Wall and the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962. At that point, after that happened, then, as I said, the two superpowers looked over the brink and said, look, we've each reached the point where we've secured our respective spheres of influence. Now the time has come to reopen bridges with each other, and you got the communications line, the hotline between the Pentagon and the Kremlin, things like that being set up and sorted out. And for a period of time in the 60s and 70s, there was a real relaxation of tension. So I think we are very much still at that initial period of extreme superpower tensions. And with communications breaking down, there's a real danger that they're going to get very much worse.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I was thinking of the Cold War as well, and I was thinking, God, if we could just, I just can't find another solution to this problem, but it seems like the best way out of this mess so that we don't have a conflict is, can we get to where things were during the Cold War you know, like say the Reagan years or something along those lines, where, you know, okay, there was this bloc against that bloc, the East versus West, but at least, you know, the thing, things were stable and there was no fear that that something terrible was going to break out. Everyone knew their neighborhood and who's with us, who's with this side and who's with that side. And there was a clear cut iron curtain there. And that was that. I'm not saying it was a good situation.
No,
I'm just saying it was a stable situation.
Exactly. I mean, it was a very bad situation in many respects. And, you know, we mustn't look back on it with too much nostalgia. But as you said, it was a stable one. I mean, it meant that, you know, we could go to bed in the, you know, without at night, without worrying that, you know, we'd be in a war in the morning. But as I said, it took a long time to arrive at that point. I mean, if you think of the Cold War as really beginning in 1948, with the Berlin blockade, the Soviet imposition of the Berlin blockade, and ending in 1962 with the Cuban Missile Crisis, that first period of very tense Cold War, that was 14 years. I mean, that was 14 years of very, very high tension. Eventually, a stability was achieved. People in East Germany weren't too happy. People in Poland weren't too happy. But the world did enjoy peace. And in the West, we enjoyed great prosperity, of course, for much of that time.
That's my second question. I mean, there were people on the East side of the Iron Curtain. They suffered tremendously during the Cold War. There was stability, but a lot of people suffered tremendously under that tyranny, that system. The West prospered. In this scenario, who is going to be suffering if we even get there, who's going to be suffering? Yeah. Who's going to be prospering? I don't know. Is it going to be two tyrannous situations, both East and West?
Well, I don't have a simple answer to that question. I mean, all I will say is this: politically speaking, the Eastern side, the other side, if you like, looks in a much better shape than it did during the Cold War. I mean, you know, this is, as you correctly said, a very tyrannical authoritarian system that existed in the East. It was, had some very efficient diplomats, and it knew what it was doing much of the time, but it was very, very oppressive. It doesn't seem to me that any part of the Eurasian world is as oppressive today as that one was. And of course, in the West, we are heading towards a much more authoritarian system anyway. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't quite know who will be better off, whether we will see prosperity or whether we will see poverty. What I think it could do on balance is that it would at least be the end of these globalization fantasies. And we might start to see, as a result, people in the United States, which for me remains very much, you know, the place where entrepreneurial activity is most busy, we could start to see perhaps some kind of a return to the kind of policies that the United States used to have and which made it at one time the richest nation in the world, indisputably. I'm not sure what would happen to the other side, but I can actually see how a bipolar system might actually, in the end, play to American strengths.
In order to get there, though, final question, you have to resolve Ukraine and Taiwan. I think the only resolution that would be acceptable and not lead to a war is if the West gave up its claim on Ukraine and gave up its claim on Taiwan. That doesn't seem to be happening. So we're kind of stuck. And we also have terrible leaders this time around as well,
indeed,
by the way.
Well, indeed. I mean,
that doesn't help.
that is the real problem. I mean, you know, in the Cold War, the tough period of the Cold War, we had leaders of the caliber of Eisenhower and Kennedy. I mean, look at the situation today. I mean, it's just de Gaulle and Adenauer. I mean, this is a different caliber of leadership completely from what we have today. And to be straightforward about it, the US in the 50s was far better run and a far more stable and happy country than the US is today. I mean, there weren't these tremendous partisan divides. I mean, there were There were serious issues, many problems. There were, there was the feeling of a large part of the population that it was disenfranchised. But it was a much more stable country, and one which was prepared to take action to resolve many of those problems. Today, things in the West are in far worse shape. But we'll just have to see, because it's very difficult to predict how we're going to get to that point. And resolving a problem like Ukraine or Taiwan, well, there are glimmers of realism. You get odd people who come out from time to time and come out with some ideas and suggestions. There was a very interesting article by a prominent analyst at the Rand Corporation, for example, who said that the situation in Ukraine is unsustainable and let's resolve it and let's go back to the solution charted out in the Minsk agreement. And there was, again, the usual people came out and they were furious about it and they criticised it and all that. But there are those voices of realism, whether they will ever gain traction or whether, in fact, the situation both with Taiwan and Ukraine is going to have to be resolved in a much more forceful way. I don't know. At the moment, I have to say all the drift is in the direction of the second, in which case, to be very clear, they will be resolved in a much more forceful way. And then the question is how people react to that in the West. Will we react by doing dangerous and foolish things, or will we accept that and at the same time try to chart a way forward as people accepted the realities of, you know, what the Soviets did in places like Berlin in 1961 and in Czechoslovakia in 68, because they had no alternative but to do that. Well, we'll just have to see.
Yeah, that's an excellent analogy. I was thinking the same thing. Either they're going to, if it does go down the route of a forceful type of a resolution, either the West is just going to have to accept the fact that it, and if it is a forceful resolution, it is going to, in my opinion, 99%, it's going to go in Russia's favor and 99% it'll go in China's favor.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, will the West just accept it and move on?
Yes.
And then you essentially do have this new iron curtain.
Yeah.
Or do we go into a global world war?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, to be very clear about it, and you know, this isn't something I like to say, but I'm going to say it. The creation of the Berlin Wall, terrible as it was, imprisoning people in Eastern Europe in the way that it did actually stabilize the situation in Europe for a time. I mean, it was a hideous price to pay. And it was a great moment when it finally came down. But the reason it came down in the end was because, of course, the situation in Europe in the meantime had become stable. And that enabled the underlying strengths of the American economic and political system and the weaknesses of the other system to work their way through. In the meantime, the acceptance of geopolitical realities meant that a kind of stability was brought to Europe and to the world, which hadn't existed before in the 50s. Now, I hope we don't have to pay that kind of price, but, you know, maybe we will. A terrible failure of foreign policy, if that's the way it goes.
And who's going to pay the price this time around?
Well, who's going to pay the price this time around?
Which side? Yeah. Anyway, which all side? Right. We'll leave it there. TheDuran.locals.com. Check us out there and go to Odyssey, Rumble, BitChute, and Super U. You'll find our videos there as well. And go to the Duran Shop. 10% off all merchandise when you use the code GOODDAY.